Well, hello, everybody. Hope y'all are doing well today. It's an honor to get to join you for this series. We're continuing Lost and Found. Last week, if you were here, you got to hear from my brother from another mother, Samson. Pastor Samson brought it strong. If you want to hear, you go check that out online. I encourage you to do so. But today, I would love to move us forward one more step. And I got to be honest with you, okay? I have a goal today, shockingly. I have a goal of encouraging you and challenging you in a particular fashion. So Friday night, my wife and I got to play a little bit of indoor soccer. We love to do that, but I am 31 and no longer 18, slightly less spry than I was whenever I was 18, 13 years ago. So anyway, when we're playing, I noticed that I am not quite as good at dodging, which is important whenever you're playing people that are good and strong and can kick a soccer ball like a mule. So playing defense against one of these said strong people, this guy reared back, and I think he only put about 50% of his intense power on the shot he took. But again, he was in a great position to score. I don't think the goalie had anything for it, and he put a shot on goal, like it was literally going in. But thankfully, my face was in the way, and I caught it about right, yay, on the old chin there, and man, it hurt, okay? I didn't let anybody know, okay, because that's not what you do. You act like you meant to, and you keep on rolling with it, but I let my wife know behind the scenes, honey, I'm dying. I didn't need surgery, but I did have it so bad that I went to S&B Burger later on that night where they got the bombest peanut butter burgers you've ever had in your life. Judge not till you try it, but come on. I was hurting so bad, I got a milkshake instead of a hamburger that night. Something was wrong with me. I hope that you get messed up a little bit today, and it changes you so much so that you can't leave the same way you came in. You think about it, and it gets you right where you need to be gotten, because sometimes we just need to be stirred up, right? I don't know if you guys are like me, but I'd like to do that a little bit today. And to start that, I just want to ask a question. Do you remember what it feels like to be lost? How many of you men, husbands, have been on a road trip and noticed that there may be some construction or traffic and been like, I got a faster way, or I can figure this out? And you get the map out and you start getting a little shortcut. I've done that many times. Well, my wife knows that when that happens, it's not going to go well. I've gotten us lost many times. I think I have a great sense of direction. She knows better. And I don't, but I've been lost a lot in my life. However, out of all the times that I've ended up where I didn't want to be and didn't know where I was, there's one story that sticks out above the rest. To do this story, I've got to rewind about 25 years to whenever I was 6 years old, okay? At this time, I lived with my family in Birmingham, Alabama, and we drove 13 hours southeast to the great land of Orlando, to a very magical place known as Disney World. Come on, whenever you're 6 years old and you've been crammed in a car with your gigantic family and you have to reach back in the rear window to get a breath of fresh air for 13 hours like that, and then you see Disney World, you are officially out of proportionary lit, okay? Young people know what I'm saying. I was out of control in this moment. And so we get inside the park, finally, after 10 minutes of waiting in line, felt like an eternity. We make it, I'm telling you, no more than 20 or 30 feet in, and then something amazing begins to happen. All this music starts playing, and then a parade starts. Y'all, I've been to Disney World like 5 times, okay? Yes, I'm bragging about that. I've only seen the parade 1 time, and it was this one, okay? I see Mickey Mouse go by. I see Minnie Mouse and my family. We're just kind of walking hand in hand, and all of that changed whenever my main man, Goofy, came out. Come on, the showstopper. Goofy, the best out of all the Disney characters. He came out, and my six-year-old brain was just hooked. Like, I just had this huge smile on my face. I couldn't think about what was happening. I let go of my little brother's hand who was in front of me, and since he's a little brother, he was like, finally, good, and he betrayed me in that moment and left me behind, didn't tell anybody. So here I am, stuck in this parade with people all around me just staring at Goofy, totally entranced. And then I finally snap out of it, and I look around me on all sides, And all I see are a bunch of unfamiliar backs that are twice as tall as me because I'm like, yay, and I'm in the middle of a place I've never been before. And y'all, I panicked. Instant tears, you know, the ugly crying as a six-year-old. It was really, really, really bad. People are looking at me like, oh my God, what's wrong with this child? He's at Disney World. Why is he crying? Because I was lost, okay? I was afraid. I was scared. I was alone. And it felt like it was forever, okay? It was probably about 30 seconds, okay? And I was looking on all sides. Finally, I began to see what I thought were bodies being thrown out of the way, bouncing off the buildings to the right and to the left. And then the Red Sea opened up, and then up walks the baddest mamma jamma in Disney World. My father, Greg Jones, strolling up, shoving people out of the way. And when he gets up to me, he just leans down and gives me a big hug. He said, son, no, he didn't. He snatched me up by the nape of my neck and threw me on his shoulder and said, don't you ever do that again. And the rest of my Disney World day that day was totally ruined because I was crying and traumatized forever. But here's the thing that I learned out of that. Number one, it's really, really bad to be lost. It's not fun. And number two, good fathers have a burden for their kids. They care about what happens to them, and they will let nothing stand in the way. They will fight through whatever it takes to get their kids back. And a burden is a powerful thing. A burden will move you. A burden will change you. A burden will grab a hold of your heart and not let you go. You'll lay awake at night whenever you're in your comfy bed with your comfy pillow and your comfy blankets, and you'll just sit there staring awake because it's got you. When I speak of a burden, especially a burden for the lost like we're talking about right now, I want to talk about a weight that sits on your heart, a weight and responsibility to care for the people around you. Specifically those you know are far from God, who don't know that they were created for a purpose, who don't have His loving favor on their lives, who are literally out there on their own as spiritual orphans, forgotten or left behind. A burden is a powerful thing. A burden moves us so much so that maybe we end up like Jesus. When Jesus showed and displayed the burden he had for God's lost children, it says this many times, that he just wept whenever he would think about God's lost children, the ones who don't know the Father. It wasn't like just a single tear. He literally just floodgates open. He cared. Now, the opposite side of that, of having a burden, of caring, of wondering what's going on with someone, would be apathy, right? Apathy being that we don't care. Here's the thing, though, is apathy has a strange way of being very, very subtle, okay? You don't just wind up all the time. Sometimes maybe where you just say, I'm so angry, I don't even care right now, okay? Maybe that does happen to some of you. For me, though, apathy truly becomes a comfortable distraction. We're just so busy with other good things that we miss out on the God things that are all around us. We've got all these things, and we just don't have time to help that person who we know doesn't know God, that's going through a divorce or that's going through the worst imaginable situation. We just have so many other things to do, right? We're just distracted. And we're, at the end of the day, okay with it. We've kind of settled it. We've kind of allowed that to kind of get in our hearts, and we're apathetic about the lost around us. And I've got a picture I want to paint for what this actually looks like. I want to introduce you to my friend, the dog, Humphrey. This is a picture of Humphrey here. And Humphrey's a cool guy, got a great hat, drinking coffee. We're already friends, plus he's a dog. But Humphrey's house is on fire, and that's really bad. There's smoke billowing above his head. Humphrey's just chilling, though, right? He's still drinking coffee. This is what he has to say about the situation. He simply says, this is fine, right? This is fine. My house is burning down. This is fine. It's basically showing apathy, that we are comfortably distracted in the midst of a terrible situation, right? Because I heard this a couple of years ago. It really, really shook me up in my apathetic state towards lost people all around. I heard this, that if you took the billions of people on planet Earth that don't know God, that don't know who Jesus truly is, that might have heard about him, they might have heard about the rules of Christianity and the laws and the legalism and all that stuff, but they don't know about the grace of God. If you took all of those people and you had them hold hands side by side, you don't even have to stretch them wide. You just hold hands comfortably like this. And you started here at North Church, and you wrap them around like an equator-like line around the world, they would start here in the parking lot, make it all the way around the globe at its widest point, and make it back here 37 times. Now, that's not an all-time number. That's a right now number. And here's the thing about that. You may be like me when you think about the countries on the planet that don't know God. They serve other gods. They go by other religions. They kind of live their life in this way that's not even close to Christian. But I believe this, that if God took us and showed us the faces of the people that are in those 37 lines, we'd be dumbfounded to find that our neighbor is right there. I know that. I see him cutting his grass. There's my coworker. There's my son's third grade teacher. We begin to recognize and see that these aren't people in some far away, distant, out of mind, out of sight place. They would be people that we know. And I hope that God would be able to do something in our hearts and in our lives to be able to change that for them. To go from being apathetic about it to carrying a burden that leaves us broken, feeling that pain that they go through. Now, Jesus gave us plenty of examples about how we can be effective in this way. And I want to highlight a particular book in Scripture and particular chapter within this book that's known as the chapter of lost things. This comes from Luke 15. There's three stories that Jesus tells to paint a picture about what it means to care for the lost and how much God cares for the lost, what kind of burden he has for them. And I'm going to start in verse 1. You can follow along with me in Luke 15, verse 1. This first sentence is so profound and encouraging. It says this, that tax collectors, which were the lowest of the low, and other notorious sinners often came to listen to Jesus teach. That's powerful right there to know this, that people that are far from God, walking in darkness, are still drawn to the light. Because at the core of every human, no matter where we've been or what we've done, we see the truth whenever Jesus is lifted up, and it's undeniable. But here's what happens, though, whenever we get this wrong and we're dealing with apathy towards them. It says this, that the Pharisees and teachers of religious law complained that he was associating with such people. Got upset about it, even eating with them. How dare he? So Jesus told them this story. He said, if a man has 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what will he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness and go to search for the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. When he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me because I have found my lost sheep. In the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. There's a sense of priority here. The thing that matters most, especially to the shepherd, because the shepherd in the story has an understanding of what's really going on with that sheep that is lost. The principle is this, that the lost are in peril. The lost are in danger. There's trouble lurking on all sides, and without the shepherd there to protect them or in the rest of the flock to guard them, they're defenseless against anything that can come their way. A couple of months ago, my wife Sheridan and I went out to go get breakfast, and it was a beautiful day, so we decided to leave our two dogs in the backyard. Now, Sheridan and I don't have kids yet. We're going to someday, not today, not tomorrow, but someday. So right now, these puppies, come on, y'all, they're like babies to us. I know we don't really know, fine, but they mean a lot to us. And this day of all the days we had with them, we came home after being gone for like an hour, and our oldest, Stella, she's about a year old now, the perfect, just obedient dog. She likes to bark a lot, but she's just guarding, you know, and she's a lot like my wife. She was in the backyard right where she belongs, smiling, but she could tell that there was something wrong. You know, when you know your dogs really well, you begin to see that there's something wrong. They're communicating something with the look in their eye, you know. So we knew when we got in the backyard and we were looking for the other one, okay, our younger dog, the goofball, Denali. All right, Denali is a hot mess. She reminds me of myself. And, man, our dogs are big, okay? They're big and they're also strong, which means that they are capable escape artists. Even though they're huge, they have to make big holes, they do. And this day, Denali had found some way to move the fence, don't ask me how, and get into the neighbor's yard whose gate was open. So when we got home, we saw all this transpire, did the little Sherlock Holmes detective work, and then we went into utter panic mode. Okay, we're both kind of dramatic people, my wife and I, a little emotional, very passionate, and we love our dogs. So this day was not a good day in the Jones household. We both get in each one of our cars. I'm in my truck. She's in her car. We're scouring the neighborhood because less than 100 feet in any direction, you can beat a major thoroughfare where dogs don't belong in the middle of the road, okay? And Denali is the type of dog that does not know any better, all right? If a car was coming at her, she'd probably go try to hug it. That's the bad thing. So all these thoughts are running through our minds, and it's just bad, all right? We're looking, driving through the neighborhood, and both of us somehow at the same time ended up driving in front of her house. I see Sheridan. She's just in tears, you know? She's just a mess. Because we love this dog. We rescued this dog, and we've only had her 6 months at this time. And, man, we wanted her to be okay. We knew what could have happened to her. And as we drive in front of our house, there's that little goofball sitting on the front porch, be like, Mom and Dad, where were you the whole time? I was right here waiting on y'all. We had this urgency, and we went to look for her because we knew what could have happened to her. I want you to think about this. Those hard things that you've been through since you met Jesus, for those of you who are following him, what would your life be like if he wasn't there when you went through that hard thing? Think about what those people that don't know God, don't have his protection of the shepherd in their life. What danger are they in? What could be happening? How could God protect them if he had them? Jesus moves forward in the next story. He says this in verse 8. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Won't she light a lamp and sweep the entire house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she will call in her friends and neighbors and say, rejoice with me because I found my lost coin. In the same way, there is joy in the presence of God's angels when even one sinner repents. Come on, even one. Each one matters to God. Every single one of his kids, he knows by name. He knows the number of hairs on their head. He loves us all. But here's what's significant to me out of the story. It shows us that the lost should be earnestly sought after, diligently and urgently sought after. She looks for them a long time. She sweeps the house completely from top to bottom. She even looks so long that it goes from day to night. You know how we know? Because she lit a lamp. She looked until the job was done. And here's why that matters. You may say this, that Joshua, I don't have power to save anybody. I know. Here's the truth. God does the finding, but we're called to do the searching. We're called to be a part of this with God. God's used people from the beginning of time, and he won't stop doing so. What we do for the lost matters. Here's why I think she was looking so passionately. You see, this young woman did more than have a dollar in dimes and lose one of the dimes. What she lost, the silver coin, was the equivalent of one whole day's work. She had lost what she worked an entire day for. Come on, I'm passionate about finding what I made in one day, right? Aren't you? But even more so, she is passionate about finding this because those 10 coins represent what would have been in her culture known as the dowry, okay? This young woman was probably single, and her dowry represented the wedding gift from the family of the bride to the family of the groom. The more prestigious the family, the more you had to offer, the better catch you would end up with. So here's a single lady trying to get married, trying to become a mom, have kids, and be a wife and all of this. But all of that is in jeopardy because she's lost a portion of her dowry. Come on, the whole family probably jumped in this search. We're like, we want to get you out of here. So she celebrated with her mom and dad and grandmother, and everybody was fired up. Come on, get married now. It's time. She urgently sought after what was missing. It's good to be found. It's good to be found, but it's also good to be sought after. Do you remember when you were found? Do you remember that moment whenever God changed everything in your life? I do. I remember. It was in December of 2008. And at this point in my life, most of you that maybe some of you that know me, you wouldn't recognize me because, man, when I was lost, I was real, real lost. I would definitely say at this point in my life, I just didn't like me. You know, depression would be an accurate word for my emotional state. No direction, hopeless about how to get out of the situations that I had put myself in, angry at myself because I knew it was my fault. And I remember driving in the Honda Civic that I used to own in the middle of the backwoods town in Alabama that I grew up in. And I'm so messed up that the radio isn't even on, okay? You know, if you get in my car, usually there's music playing. This night, I was just done. No sounds. And it was in the midst of that low point, that dark moment, that the voice of God reached out to me. And it wasn't audibly, it wasn't like out loud, it was to my heart though, in a language that I knew well, that I could understand. He simply said this. He said, "Son, if you're ready, if you'll let go of control, I'll take it from here." And God found me that night. The person that I used to be died, and I came from lost to found, and it was powerful, and it is good to be found. But y'all, it's just as good in that process to be searched for, because they're one and the same. You see, preceding that day in 2008, the 22 years prior, one of the most devout Christians to walk the planet was searching for that moment for me. My Nana has been praying for me since the day I was born. And let me tell you, I put her through some dark days in her prayer and belief in me getting found. Whenever I was 14 years old, she sat me down at the dinner table and looked me in the eye and said, "Joshua, someday God's going to use you to share his word, but you got to give him control." It took me 10 years to finally come to a point to where I was willing to relinquish that. And she chose to still believe in me and talk to me about the Lord. Do you know what it feels like? Maybe some of you do. To have someone that knows you and loves you and cares for you look you in the eye and ask you the question, "Do you know Jesus as your Lord and Savior?" I do. She did that for me. And even though much of the time when she was praying for me, I spent more time in bars than I did in churches, Nana did not give up. Nana searched and searched and prayed and cried and loved me until God found me. And guess what? You needed it too. You did. We do. We all need that. We all have needed that. The lost around you are no different than you. The lost around me are no worse than me. They're just desperate sinners in need of someone who cares enough to search for them, to pray for them, to invite them to church, to show them Jesus. The Apostle Paul puts it this way in Philippians chapter 2. He says, "Go out into the world uncorrupted, a breath of fresh air in the squalid and polluted society. Provide people with a glimpse of good living and of the living God. Carry the light-giving message into the night, so I'll have good cause to be proud of you on the day that Christ returns." Into the night, when it doesn't make sense, when it's hard, when there's a cost associated with being available for the people who are hurting around you. Into the night, carry the life-giving message of the gospel. Now, there's one more story in this chapter that I want to share with you, but instead of telling you, I want to show you today. So, if you would, enjoy this.
There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country. There, squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am, starving to death." I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied. 'And your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'
Welcome the lost. Found people find people. People that know what it's like to go from lost to found. Know the pain, know the brokenness, they know the shame, but they also know how they were found. The way that this father didn't punish the son who had done wrong, didn't cast judgment, condemnation, but opened his arms, welcomed them back in to his proper position as a son, beloved, honored, and blessed. This is God. This is Jesus. While we were of no use to God and still sinners, Christ died for us so that God could welcome us in with open arms. And I can imagine how angry he gets whenever people stand in the way and tell people what they have to do in order to earn God's love back, mistakenly thinking that we can do enough to deserve something so precious as forgiveness and grace. The father in the story stands in opposition to that approach. He's the father of not just one lost son, though. You see, we see the one in obvious blatant sin and in rebellion, but what about the other son? Why does Jesus even bring him into the story? I think he wants us to get the picture that apathy and being judgmental, not caring about the plight of the lost, is just as deep of a sin as running from God. You see, one son was lost out of the father's house, but one son was lost in the father's house. He missed the father's heart and did not carry a burden for loss, only cared about himself. It's time we get this. It's time we wake up to our own selfishness that turns us to people that only care about what's done for us. You throw a party for someone else, celebrate them. What about all the things that I've done? What about the countless hours I've spent serving for the church? And I've never been hero of the week. God just, he stands in opposition. And it says, this is why you're alive, to carry a burden, to reach for those who are lost. There's another point that I want to drive out of the story. You see, I believe that young people are experiencing this all around us. In this church, in this community, young boys and girls are lost because they don't have a guide. This father points them both gently in the right direction, and I believe that there are so many young people missing that. Not just from their parents, they're missing that from others who could and should be helping. Now, that plight, that struggle that they go through is why I have a job here at North Church. Because they have such potential. Because they have such a huge impact that they can make on the world around us. But they just need someone to believe in them. They just need someone who sees into any entitlements, any laziness, any struggles that they're going through and says, I'm not going to judge them for it. I'm going to help them through it. There are men and women who pour into young people every single week through our student ministry called Revolution, but the need is greater and the workers are few. If there's anything within you, men and women, that says, I believe I can make a difference, I've got a spot for you on my team. I'd love for you to join us as one generation, looking into the one coming behind us and saying, I'm going to help you go from being lost to becoming found. It reminds me of another group of lost youngins. Y'all know the story of Peter Pan. Some lost boys and girls running around out there. And just like Captain Hook's after them, there's a plan for their souls from evil. Not until we got the story from Hook where Peter Pan was a grown person did we see someone lead them against evil to fight because he said, I'm going to help. They're capable of doing great things. I want to show you a picture of what just a few of them did over their spring break. This is a photo of about 30 young people that started about 7:30 a.m. and finished at about 4:30 p.m. repairing and painting the house behind you. What you see is a finished product. Before then, it was just in tatters, but for absolutely free, they showed up and blessed this woman. They're capable of doing great things. Just like all people who are far from God, living in sin are. God has called us to reach them. Proverbs 11:30 encourages us with this. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. And he who is wise wins souls. Wise because there's no higher calling. Wise because there's no greater work to be done. Wise because it is simply the most important thing to do in the entire universe, because eternity is much longer than the life we live here on earth.